So let's begin. Our business this morning, as we go closer and closer to our own time, but still counts as history, is to look at patrilineal descent. Is to look at patrilineal descent and its implications, not just for Reform Judaism, but really for all of American Judaism, and I would even argue for situation Yehudi, the situation in Israel as well. It had real far-reaching impact. It was what historians call in the 1980s the age of fracture. This was happening in economics. It was happening politically. Think about Ronald Reagan. If you think about the 1980s, it really is this incredibly interesting point in which the middle ground sort of lost its footing. But before we get there, and happy to take questions in the chat. I've had some people request that we save questions until the end, but certainly if there's something that you feel is absolutely necessary, by all means, interrupt, not interrupt, be a part of this conversation. I want to first take us to the late 1960s, but truly the 1970s, when Reform Judaism was reconsidering its position on mixed marriages. By the 1920s, the Central Conference of American Rabbis and their Responsa Committee had passed resolution which made much, much easier for non-Jews to convert to Judaism. And those bar because the barriers of entry were softened, issues of intermarriage really didn't come up all that often. But in the 1960s, particularly after Look magazine, some 3 years earlier, had published Thomas Morgan's well-known feature piece, The Vanishing American Jew, to out not just assimilation and intermarriage among American Jews, but also rabbis who were somehow countenancing it, all of a sudden became a much more public affair. Max Eichhorn of New York was leading the charge, who assembled a list, a not so public, actually, I have a copy of the list, of Reform rabbis who were on record, some record, Eichhorn's record, of being willing to perform intermarriage ceremonies. Here's a letter from Rabbi Birkhorn, actually of Philadelphia, not too far away from Gratz Colleges, to Rabbi Eichhorn. My dear Max, this is 1969, the left side. I am very happy that someone has been farsighted and industrious enough to get to work and compile a list, the list of our colleagues who will perform an intermarriage without requiring the non-Jewish partner to convert. Again, converting, it wasn't a very high bar. It'd be willing to identify Jewishly, certainly, but the actual ritual and level of education, all the other pre-conversion activities. I don't want to actually, I don't mean to slight a non-Jew's decision to convert to Judaism in any section of Jewish life, but certainly the prerequisites were softened already by the 1920s. This has been our policy for several years now, and as far as I know, there's only one other Reform rabbi in the greater Philadelphia area who goes along with this philosophy. K.I., Knesset Israel, was one of the more radical, still is, one of the more radical Reform congregations in the United States. We do set certain conditions, explains Birkhorn, who many of you may know as one of the great historians of Judaism during the Civil War, that this be the only religious ceremony performed for this couple, too. That the couple make a verbal promise at a pre-marriage interview that their household would be oriented toward Judaism and that the children that issue from this marriage be raised as Jews. Have an interfaith couple, according to Birkhorn, according to Rabbi Korn, but they have to augur their home in the spirit of the Jewish faith. You may add my name and the names of Rabbi Alan Fuchs and Rabbi Arnold Fink. At the same address to your list, assistant rabbis. We are looking forward to receiving your completed list as soon as it is ready. So, I hope that all is going well with you. Bye. So Eichhorn is developing this list, which comes out in a year or two. And people are not necessarily shy about including their name on this list. However, some are very upset in the reform movement. If you take a look at an article, a letter, excuse me, to from a very important rabbi, Arthur Lelieveld, of Cleveland, you see that this is by a non-pulpit rabbi. Here's only the first of two pages. And he, in the larger paragraph in the middle, I cannot possibly look upon the CCAR, the Central Conference of American Rabbis. This rabbi is very disturbed about his affiliation with the Reformed Rabbinical Group as a group of Achim Ledea, right? These brothers of one mind, of one vision, colleagues, when that group also consists of atheists, agnostics, ignostics, and mixed marriagers whose goals and objectives are absolutely antithetical to my own. I have more in common with Seymour Siegel, leader in the conservative movement, than with Alvin Reines. More in common with the Lubavitcher Rebbe than with Sherwin Wine, and more in common, so more of a, Sherwin Wine was part of a humanist effort within Reform Judaism, in common with the Orthodox British Chief Rabbi than with Michael Lubberkian. Obviously, therefore, the CCAR as such cannot represent my religious identification. Check the chat. Here is Rabbi Alexander Schindler, who became the architect of the patrilineal descent resolution, which would finally pass by 1983. I do have, Shelley has a question. Sure, Shelley, go ahead.
Could you give me, what do you think the motivation was? The motivation could be cynical, or the motivation could be seeing the both the sexual revolution and the growing tide of intermarriage. It could be because people aren't interested in religion anymore, and we got to get people in to pay the bills. Or it could be because, well, we just feel that the future of Judaism is we have to get more people. We want. This is America, and we can make people very excited about it, and we're going to go off in a new direction. Which one was it?
It's a really, really interesting question. So it's always hard for historians to identify what's in people's hearts, what's in people's minds. There's a lot of things happening, right? The 1960s is the sexual revolution and this idea of, and now the young people of the 60s are a little older as these things work out in the 70s and we move into the 80s. What's happening right now is Reform Judaism is very much on the defensive against the rise of conservative Judaism, but they're not much really the Orthodox at the time. That wouldn't happen for another 10 or 20 years. So certainly they are trying to increase their numbers by hook or by crook to compete in the hinterland, in the suburban areas against conservative Judaism. There's also put on guard, I mentioned Look magazine's there, Vanishing American Jew, of somehow incorporate that. Flipping, turning assimilation on its head. That anti-assimilation as an affront to Judaism can be turned as actually this is a tool to grow American Judaism. That was very much in their minds. And then I think finally is Reform Judaism, unlike conservative and Orthodox Judaism, has been at its core an evangelical religious movement in Judaism. What I mean is they have always looked to convert, actively looked to convert people to Reform Judaism since inception in the 19th century, especially in America. And so because Reform Judaism has looked for kind of maybe to some of us that sounds strange, but Alexander Schindler, who was the head of what we now call the Union of Reform Judaism, the Hebrew congregation, the congregational body of Reform Judaism, the conversation began with its missionizing work. And so Reform Judaism has always looked to spread its vision to as many people as possible. But we'll see. So here's Rabbi Alexander Schindler. This is at a talk he gave in Houston in 1978. I begin with a recognition of a reality. The tide of intermarriage is running against us. Statistics on the subject confirm what our own experience teaches us. Intermarriage is on the rise. Between 1966 and 1972, 31.7% of all marriages involving a Jew were marriages between a Jew and a person born a non-Jew. A person born a non-Jew, meaning they could have converted beforehand. And a recent survey shows that the acceptance of such marriages among Americans in general, this is part of the, I guess you would say, the sexual revolution, is on the rise, most dramatically, as we might expect, among Jews. I believe that we must do everything possible to draw the non-Jewish spouse of mixed marriages into Jewish life. They're already attending synagogue, or they're already married to somebody who did or does attend synagogue. The phenomenon of Jewish drift teaches us that we ought to be undertaking more intensive Jewish programs, which will build on and build up these existing ties. This fledgling sense of Jewish identification. If non-Jewish partners can be brought more actively into Jewish communal life, perhaps they themselves will initiate the process of conversion. At the very least, we will dramatically increase the probability that the children of marriages will be reared as Jews. So here's an answer to some of Shelley's questions. I should add one other component, which is civic life. So before there was the Pew study, every 10 years or so, the Jewish Federations of North America would execute a very ambitious national census of the Jewish population in the United States. There was one done in 1990, which really escalated fears of intermarriage and injected huge billions of dollars of philanthropic resources into Jewish education. There was a very fraught study done in 2001. There was one done in the 80s, which didn't get so much attention. But the first one of these studies done was in the early 1970s. It began in 1971. It was concluded in 1974. Those surveys are meant to inform how federations and how foundations and other grant-making institutions should allocate and invest in social capital. Federations at that time were separate from the religious space. If you think about it, so many of these are federations, wherever you're located, were first described as the United Jewish Appeal. They were looking for an appeal for, more often than not, Israel. Federations were a means for supporting social services locally, and certainly trying to convince its members to purchase Israel bonds and the like. But they were very much a wing, a philanthropic division, rightfully so, to somehow move philanthropic dollars from the United States to Israel. By the 1960s and 1970s, federations had decided, you know what, enough was enough. And we need to play a role in religious life, in education, which was once the province of the rabbinate or the religious sections. Think about how many of you daven in a shul that has an unused space that used to be the synagogue school. Very often. All right. So all of a sudden, federation had almost like a truce with the American rabbinate. We will be the civic, the secular arm of the Jewish community. You guys handle. Guys, because we do not have ordained women until the Reform Movement ordains Rabbi Sally Priesen in 1972. You worry about Jewish religious life and education. And by that first Jewish population study, Federation recognizes that they need to get involved philanthropically and programmatically in religious life. And what Alexander Schindler is also reacting to is the need for Reform Judaism, which still fancied itself the largest of the major movements in American Jewish life, that he was the leading rabbinic figure in all of American Jewish life and was in some very real respects combating the federation, the civic divisions of Jewish life, in his mind, to infiltrate and make decisions on religious life. The Vanishing American Jew op-ed and the entire output and reaction to it around assimilation started to convince people that rabbis had failed over the last 10 or 20 years in preserving the integrity of Jewish identity and Jewish life. and I'm making a decision. I'm just reporting the news some 60 years later. And what's motivating Reform Judaism is to recapture the mantle of religious leadership in the United States. Just want to react to any questions. We'll get to sort of the implications of intermarriage towards the end. See a question about that. Interesting question about, were those intermarrying really likely to be attending services? There's a little bit of work on it. Well, it depends on who is the Jew among the couple. If it is a woman, early studies, again, I don't know how socially scientific they were, the Jewish woman of the couple would be attending services, the man not so much. Hence sort of the gendered components, not just the halachic one, but the gendered components of this issue. So the very first time the issue was brought up at the annual conference of the Central Conference of American Rabbis was formally in 1982, and it lost. The movement for patrilineal descent was defeated by the opposition. Rabbi Sheldon Zimmerman speaking before the vote, speaking con against the amendment, Mr. Chairman. We began this meeting with a discussion to enlarge somehow that class which we call the Jewish people, to reach out to children of mixed marriages and to include as part of our people both the children of Jewish mothers and the children of Jewish fathers. The amendment comes along to tell us that not only shall we not enlarge the group, we shall diminish it. I'm a rabbi who does not officiate at mixed marriages, a shrinking number. Now I am told that any child of Jewish mother in a mixed marriage whom I have considered a Jew up to this point, who has not received a Jewish education, is not a Jew. I'll get more about that in a moment. Here I am, their rabbi, supposedly not performing mixed marriages, but in fact, by our new definition, having been performing mixed marriages. How can we as rabbis maintain such a position of exclusion when we talk about diminishing Jewish population? How can we maintain such a position of exclusion after Auschwitz? There's very much of a Holocaust imagery in the background of all this discussion. You'll see that in a moment when you see Alexander Schindler's response to all this. How can we in conscience say to anyone who wants to be a Jew, you are not a Jew because your parents did not give you a Jewish education? This conference must never in principle or in name never go on record with that kind of statement. This amendment is basically against the Jewish people, Mr. Chairman. Michael Stroh says something a little bit different. He's from Canada, and Canada, even to this day, is more religiously traditional in all phases than the United States. I've been nominated by the Canadian region of the CCAR to speak on their behalf in opposition to the motion. We have had from the committee that prepared the motion three speakers this evening, each one disagreeing with the others. The first proposed accepting the motion as it stood, which would enfranchise all children of Jewish fathers. The second recommended not passing the resolution as it stands at all. The third recommended a resolution which, if passed, would have the possibility of disenfranchising the children of Jewish mothers. I know that's not clear. I'll make it clear in a moment, hopefully. Would have the possibility of disenfranchising mothers. If there is such division on the committee, can you imagine how much division there is in the CCAR, Central Conference of American Rabbis, the Reform Rabbinical Group, on this issue? I hope everyone recognizes that the amendment we passed turned upside down the proposal that Rabbi Schindler had made. And we are now voting on disenfranchising the children of Jewish mothers. The resolution says they're Jewish when they participate in Jewish life. I have not a clue as to what participation in Jewish life means. Does it mean going to the Y or joining a Zionist organization? I suggest that every rabbi will consider different people Jewish and will no longer have a consistent position on who is Jewish and who is not in the Reform movement. Anyone can interpret the resolution as the way he wants. So what is this business? The CCAR had an idea. They didn't actually like the term patrilineal descent. They preferred non-linear. They suggested, as the original resolution, and basically how it was eventually passed a year later, that in order to be considered Jewish, it meant you had to, kind of sounds like if anybody's a football fan, what's considered to be a catch. You need to do a football action. You need to have a Jewish action. So the inside joke for football fans. For the reform movement to consider somebody Jewish in the 1982 resolution, which was refused, wasn't that a Jewish, a child of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother will now be considered Jewish, meaning you can trace your Jewishness from your father rather than your mother, which would change what we understood from the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, which is the original proof text for matrilineal descent. Took it for granted that everybody here understood that traditional Judaism for millennia accepted that one is Jewish if their mother is Jewish, not necessarily if their father is Jewish. There are questions about how, I'm not getting into, I'm a modern Jewish historian, so I won't get into when exactly, how far back that goes. Not my business. But suffice it to say that traditional Judaism accepts matrilineal descent over patrilineal descent. What Reform Judaism suggested at this time, or the leaders of this resolution that failed, was that forget about matrilineal, patrilineal. What you need to do is have a Jewish parent and have a background or some commitment to Jewish identity. So those calls to refute the resolution in 1982 was, wait a second. I've been working with people with very thin Jewish backgrounds. You're going to tell me now that the child of a Jewish mother isn't really Jewish unless they've had confirmation or a bat mitzvah, that they needed to give to Israel bonds, they needed to participate in a BBYO convention in order to be considered Jewish? Isn't biology enough? You're changing the definitionally what is a Jew. And that's what's happening in those texts. Perhaps the strongest argument came from Moses Cyrus Wheeler, who was the head of Maram, which is the leading reform, maybe the only lead reform organization in Israel, who by 1983 is dealing with Nehudi, who's dealing with what was passed in the early 1950s, that of the law of return, that anyone who is a Jew has a place in Eretz Yisrael can come. And Reform Judaism had been working very, very hard to achieve some sort of status in Israel. And Wheeler was at the forefront of this and thought that any movement to recalibrate Jewish identity in the United States or globally by the Reform movement would deeply jeopardize his chances to achieve standing religiously in Israel, whether by conversion, whether by marriage and the like, recognizing a modicum of religion, of marriage and divorce standards by the Reform movement. It would all be jeopardized, Wheeler thought, if they accepted Schindler's position. The world movements of conservative and Reform Judaism have for years struggled successfully to prevent the amendments. So he's delivering this in 1983. The year later, eventually, the resolution would pass in 1983. They have struggled successfully to prevent the amendment of the law of return, which would invalidate conversion performed by non-Orthodox rabbis abroad. Said, we've been working really hard to make sure that the Rabbanut and that the Orthodox rabbin in the United States doesn't take over status, religious status, totally and completely in Israel. As of now, the state of Israel and its secular institutions recognize Reform converts as Jews in every respect. However, the post-CCAR resolution, which abandons the requirement of Gior conversion, would result in a situation whereby persons recognized by our movement in America as Jews would not, even under the present law, be recognized by the state of Israel as Jews. Furthermore, the resolution will undoubtedly weaken the determination of those forces in the state of Israel who stand with us in opposition to amending the law of return. And under the backdrop of Israel and status, that's really, really important. Wheeler was not heard by a majority. In March 1983, the report of the committee on patrilineal descent, on the status of children of mixed marriages. The Central Conference of American Rabbis declares that the child of one Jewish parent is under the presumption, is a chazakah, presumption of Jewish descent. This presumption of the Jewish status of the offspring of any mixed marriage is to be established through appropriate and timely public and formal acts of identification, which with the Jewish faith and people. The performance of these mitzvot serves to commit those who participate in them, both parent and child, to Jewish life. Depending on circumstances, mitzvot leading to, so what is this, these Jewish moments that would move Jewish status from a presumption to something more concrete. Depending on circumstances, mitzvot leading toward a positive and exclusive Jewish identity will include entry into the covenant, acquisition of a Hebrew name, Torah study, bar bat mitzvah, and Kabbalat Torah confirmation. For those beyond childhood claim Jewish identity, other public acts or declarations may be added or substituted after consultation with the rabbi. So in 1983, they lowered the bar over what a Jewish act could be that would solidify one's Jewish identity. And because of lowering that bar on moving from presumption to concrete Jewish status, a majority approved the change for the reform movement's purposes of patrilineal descent under these standards. So we have a bunch of in the chat. Right. I will stay away from Tanakh on this one. Shelley, you have a question.
Yes. I, the original Reform rabbis who were willing to perform the intermarriages, were they at that point willing to do so if the non-Jewish partner brought in the clergy person from their particular family, like a Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, or what? Were they willing to perform it then, or were they only willing to perform it if they were the only ones doing it? And the couple said that they would at least raise the kids Jewish.
We don't have terrific data on this. There were so the question is, would they perform the ceremony with another religious leader of a different faith? And some did and some didn't. Some preferred, I will perform the marriage, said the Reform rabbi, if I'm the only officiant. There wasn't one way to do it. These things would become formalized only moving forward in the 80s. That's a good question.
What about Brit Mila?
Brit Mila. What about it? Did they require it?
Yes.
Not always. Joyce, you had your hand up. I can't hear you.
This 1983 resolution seems to indicate anybody of one Jewish parent is Jewish if they do identifying Jewish acts. So that sounds that somebody with a Jewish mother who, right, you know, never set foot in a synagogue or a Y or anything, with according to what you just read, they're not accepted by the Reform. I don't know if that's, I was not aware that that ever happened.
Correct. And that was the angst about it already in 1982.
Right, but they passed it. They didn't change it. They didn't say.
To your point, I'll read Rabbi Jerome Molino and Rabbi Alexander Schindler directly after that. You'll enjoy this.
All right, thank you.
What are we uneasy about? And look at the language. Being machmirim, we have been condemned over and over because we have taken the easy way out, or have seemed to take the easy way out. And I was using very rabbinic language. If there is a suffix doubt about the Jewishness of a child who has one non-Jewish parent, then it applies equally, and the suffix has to be resolved. For once, Reform Jews, let's be machmir. Let's say that if somebody has a Jewish mother but has not any background in Jewishness or has ever identified as a Jew, forget about it. They're not Jewish until they take that act. Why should Reform Judaism not take the lead on requiring an active participation in the Jewish community? Alexander Schindler, at the height of the Cold War, offers the following. Let me give you a dramatic case in point. traditional Judaism denies the Jewishness of Ben-Gurion's grandson. Ben-Gurion's son married somebody who wasn't identified as a Jew because his mother was converted to Judaism by a Reform rabbi, yet accord Jewishness to a grandchild of Khrushchev because the mother, Khrushchev's daughter-in-law, was a Jewess. So playing a Cold War card, says Schindler, wait a second. These Orthodox rabbis, the king of the Jews, David Ben-Gurion, you're going to say his ain't a cult, that his grandchild isn't Jewish? Of course he is. How could you not say Ben-Gurion isn't Jewish? Or the descendants, rather, of Ben-Gurion aren't Jewish. But the Orthodox rabbin's willing to consider Khrushchev. If he was Nitkarev al Yedei Chabad, somewhere in Moscow, wouldn't need to go through a conversion. What business is this? So, Joyce, exactly your point. It was really important for Reform Judaism to pay, at least for them, the Reform rabbinical leaders, to pay attention to their peers in the conservative and the Reform, in the Orthodox movements. Going back to into the late 1950s, Hermann Wolk was not a rabbi, but wrote probably the most important book on Orthodox. You didn't call it that, but Orthodox Jewish Life, This Is My God, offered the following. Will the Orthodox discard their fealty to the law and acknowledge the wisdom of Reform and conservative improvisations? The time for that would seem to have been in the 19th century. The Orthodoxy has survived and recovered from the impact of modern dissent, meaning the emergence of Reform and conservative Judaism. Individuals indeed continue to drift away. There has been a well-known cascading from Orthodox to conservative and from conservative to Reform groups, but Reform does not swell as it might because of attrition into disinterest and loss of identity, nor, curiously, does Orthodoxy seem to diminish. His demographic numbers are a little bit in question, but at least that represents an attitude of the Orthodox. Moving forward in Moment Magazine to September 1979, there is this interesting symposium, a dialogue between different young people who identify different religious movements. The interviewer, I don't want to be on trial here. The question is how you feel about Reform Jews like me. The answer from an Orthodox Jewish woman in Boston, I don't feel about you. I don't even think about you. This is not a, this is a modern Orthodox Jew living in Brookline, Massachusetts in the late 1970s. I hate to be mean, but when I stop to think about it, I say, you must have a hell of a problem. I've got it made. And when I look at our Orthodox community in Brookline, I see that we haven't yet lost one person. Not one kid has rebelled or opted out. And this is really creating an unnerving situation for Reform Judaism, the emerging self-confidence of not just the Orthodox rabbinate, but the Orthodox Jewish community as a whole in the last decades of the 20th century. Professor Jacob Petkowski, who is a virulent opponent of patrilineal descent, he is a very important liturgy scholar at Hebrew Union College, has the ear of many people. He's very, very upset about the decision to adopt patrilineal descent in the Journal of Reform Judaism, Reform Judaism's Diminishing Boundaries, The Grin That Remained. If I were an Orthodox rabbi, I would not join in the hue and cry against Reform Judaism that has become fashionable of late in Orthodox circles, both in the state of Israel and elsewhere. The current Orthodox attacks on Reform Judaism treat Reform Judaism as though it were a serious competitor for the souls of religiously committed Jews. There was indeed a time when Reform Judaism represented such a threat to Orthodoxy, but that time is gone. Reform has passed through a number of metamorphoses since then, and the souls that it attracts today are hardly the souls of people for whom Orthodox Judaism would represent a live option. In the conservative movement, things are a little bit trickier. The National Jewish Post and Opinion So says Gerson Cohen, the leader of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Conservatism studies patrilineal descent. In the pages of the New York Times, its longtime religion editor, Ari Goldman, conservatives reaffirm rule on determining Jewishness. And it's both articles place Gerson Cohen at the crosshairs, suggesting that he, and it's a question of is he doing this for real or not, is Gerson Cohen trying to move the conservative movement to adopt some form of patrilineal descent? This is in the wake of the patrilineal decision. This is in 1984, 1985, a year and two after Reform Judaism has adopted that position. Gerson Cohen writes to the Rabbinical Assembly, basically, and to the faculty of the Jewish Theological Seminary, as well as the rabbinical students in March 1985. The New York Times article of March 12th concerning the Rabbinical Assembly's convention session of the previous day is both inaccurate and misleading. I never mentioned the question of patrilineality either on the floor of the convention, which is telling the truth about that certainly, or at any of the press conferences. Indeed, I sat through the session at which the subject came up without participating in the discussion at all. In my own address, which came too late in the evening to be included in the press story, I did not mention the issue. You may then ask, what did happen? Simply, the convention voted to continue the conservative movement's traditional stand on the question of who is a Jew, meaning to adopt matrilineal descent, to wit, the child of a Jewish mother, or one halakhically converted. This decision was made on the merits of the issue as those present understood them. The vote was taken on a resolution, one of a dozen or more submitted to the convention by its resolutions committee. It could not have been a rebuff to me since my views on the subject were not known on the convention. That's not exactly true, though. The author of the Times story may have felt that he knew my views since we had discussed the matter privately, but he had no way of knowing what the convention's reaction would have been had I decided to raise the issue, nor could he have known what view I might have presented. In all honesty, I must tell you that I would not oppose having the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, so the rabbinical responsive committee, essentially, address themselves to the issue. There are very few questions that could not be clarified by open discussion among scholars. But authorizing or endorsing such a discussion in no way prejudges its results. In that, as on all other matters of Jewish law, I and the conservative movement will continue to be guided by the halakhic process as we understand it, and as our official decisor, the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, interprets it. I regret any misunderstandings which have arisen from the story. So Gerson Cohen, who is a very prominent medieval Jewish historian at Columbia in the seminary, and then becomes the head of JTS after Louis Finkelstein, says, and he's correct, he certainly did not play any active role in the rabbinical assembly meeting, in the prior meeting. But he did have personal views, and he does acknowledge that he wouldn't be averse to it. And he is interested in an article, presented and published by Professor Shia Cohen, who was at the seminary and then moves to Harvard University, that traces, matrilineal descent, dates it at a particular time, suggesting that maybe it's open to interpretation. According, he doesn't get involved, does Professor Cohen, on the present issue. But the article is used to discuss the matter, and Gerson Cohen is warm to the discussion of it. Which brings me to the Union for Traditional Conservative Judaism. It's the organization that would eventually drop conservative from its title and become the Union of Traditional Judaism, that is founded after the decision to ordain women at the seminary. They are the students of Professor Saul Lieberman, who dies a few years before this. They are led, you see on the right, by their leaders, their rabbinical lodestar they're all. It's Halivni, it's other people who identify with a more traditional focus on conservative Judaism. At this time in 1985, they are looking to capture the right flank of the conservative movement using the descriptor conservative in their organization's title. And their departure from conservative ranks, or at least the JTS broad rank, you see in the spirit of Salman Schechter, We talked about this before, about Schefter being more of a wide net caster. Conservative Judaism has a real problem. They have a real organizational problem at this moment, because about 12 years, 20 years, in the late 1960s, the left flank, Reconstructionist Judaism and Mordechai Kaplan have left the core of conservative Judaism. So you lose the left. And now the right wing, after the decision to ordain women, has departed from the mainstream, of conservative Judaism, leaving just the vital center to be vulnerable. The center is strongest with both a left and a right flank. So right, the leaders of the Union for Traditional Conservative Judaism, again, now known as UTJ, dear colleague, writing a letter to all of its members, we are not reassured by the chancellor's disavowal of the New York Times article and his letter to the RA, which we just read in the previous slide. He neither denies nor apologizes for having repeatedly gone to the press as a champion of patrilineal dissent. This is just more of the same, they say, of Gerson Cohn moving the movement away from Schefter's vision. Everyone is entitled to his own opinion, of course, but there are several things about Dr. Cohn's actions which trouble us deeply. And you can see, and I think Torah Motion will send the slides a little bit. You can read it at your leisure. Reform, however, is most nervous about the Orthodox, not because the Orthodox are ripping away members, certainly not, but in their imagination, there is a certain, and I've written a book about this called Authentically Orthodox, not to suggest that authenticity is somehow an objective definition. Somebody can be authentic, but there's an emotional, when one claims authenticity, when one looks at somebody who they judge to be authentic, there's an emotional response. Therefore, it is really, really important for Reform Judaism that look to the Orthodox as somehow an authentic form of Judaism, of traditional Judaism, that they not fray ties so completely. So here is a letter from the Agudas HaRabbanim, which was sent to the Central Conference of American Rabbis, CCAR, in 1984, in the name of hundreds of learned venerable rabbis who are steadily engaged in the struggle to preserve the sacredness of the Jewish family and to agonize the sacredness of the Jewish family. So this is also with the rise of divorce, certainly in the United States, the nuclear family, and who agonized with the whole Jewish nation over the many breaches made in the fortress of Torah Judaism by willful wicked elements from within. We, the undersigned members of the Beit Din, turn to the leaders of the Reform movement with an urgent plea to reject and drop all attempts to introduce into Judaism any proposal to recognize the child of a non-Jewish mother as being Jewish. A child whose mother is not Jewish is a Gentile and can in no way be classified as a Jew except by proper conversion. We urge you to publicly repudiate your declaration of patrilineal descent in the same public manner in which you issued that prohibited and deplorable declaration last March. Should you, God forbid, not repudiate it, say the leaders of the Agudas HaRabbanim, we will be forced to promulgate a halachic prohibition for Jews to marry members of your communities and congregate them. They were so warm to it before. The burden of guilt for this harsh but unavoidable step will be upon you forever, while the people of Israel and the Beit Din will be innocent before God. In the pages of the New York Jewish Week, an open letter to American Reform Jews, the Merkaz HaRabbanim, another rabbinical group, also, maybe in a little more, with a little more finesse, repudiates the decision to accept patrilineal descent. Moving the buttons, the Zoom controls. Rabbi Reuven Bolka of Canada, who really represents the Rabbinical Council of America and the modern Orthodox position on it, he writes a book called The Coming Cataclysm, The Orthodox Reform Rift and the Future of the Jewish People. Yaakov Elman, very important professor, one of my teachers, at Yeshiva University, not a rabbi, but also attacks Reform Judaism. And then Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, it was by then chief rabbi of the British Commonwealth, reform policies increase the likelihood that sometime Orthodoxy will see reform as it saw Christianity as a separate religion. Agudas HaRabbanim publish their attack finally, and this is published in Jewish Week as well. The Agudas HaRabbanim is the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the U.S. and Canada. They warn not to pray in reform or conservative temples. They weren't encouraging it beforehand, of course. By 1986, David Ellenson, who would eventually become the president, fortunately passed away a little time ago. He delivers a speech in front of the CCAR, and 3 years after the decision to adopt patrilineal descent, he is by then a professor, at that point a professor at Hebrew Union College. He would eventually become the president. I close with a final comment. When I was a boy, no Jewish ceremony had a greater impact on me than the ritual of Duchenin, which took place in my father, in my family synagogue. He was raised as an Orthodox Jew. As in all traditional synagogues in the diaspora, during the Musaf service on the three pilgrimage festivals of Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot, as the priest, Kohen, would bless the people, a sense of Kedusha, of holiness and mystery, would pervade the room. I recall that ceremony at this moment because the priests, immediately prior to their recitation of the priestly benediction, would recite the words, "Blessed are you, O Lord, our God, ruler of the universe, who has sanctified us with the holiness of Aaron and commanded us, L'Baracha et Amo Yisrael Bahava, to bless God's people, Israel, with love." It is the only bracha blessing that I am aware of that demands love, Ahava, as an essential component in its fulfillment. Action and intention must be one. The priest must bless this people, Israel, with love. Otherwise, the mitzvah is not complete. In an unredeemed world, we cannot strive for less. In serving this people, Israel, out of love and with compassion, we do honor to ourselves and make our most enduring contribution to Klal Yisrael. Let the worst accusation hurled against us as a movement be this, that we are attempting to serve the people Israel with too much love, too much compassion. When is God exalted? It is when God is exalted. Ellenson is responding to cries already by 1986 to accede to the challenge of the Orthodox rabbinate to repeal patrilineal descent, essentially says the genie is out of the bottle, but let's stick with our guns. And for that, and also his unimpeachable scholarship, Ellenson becomes the leader in the coming decades of the reform movement, stemming the tide of those who would like to repeal the decision to move in that direction. Yitz Greenberg, the pillorying doesn't stop. Yitz Greenberg, the patrilineal decision, a blow to Jewish unity. So in all Orthodox circles, from the left all the way to the right, the chief rabbi, Avraham Shapira, chief rabbi, urges greater unity in U.S. Orthodoxy, encouraging reform movement to repeal patrilineal descent. It doesn't happen. In the pages of the Agudas Yisrael's Jewish Observer, and it's also, there's a whole huge symposium in the pages of Judaism, which is not supported by the American Jewish Congress at the time, discussing patrilineal descent, American Jews without Torah, perhaps in 1996, so it's already some 12 years later. You have a whole slew of writers, including Rabbi Shafran, who becomes an important leader in the Agudah world, as well as the Novominsky Rebbe, Yaakov Perlow, decrying Reform Judaism, that finally Orthodoxy cannot be part of a united American Judaism. There are multiple Judaisms at play in American Jewish life. So I think as we sort of examine the sources, and still there are folks, the debate is not over, certainly, but Reform Judaism did not back down to the calls both within the right-wing sector of the conservative movement and across the board in Orthodox Judaism. That it happened, particularly in the 1980s, with Miyuhudi, with Jewish status in Israel in the background, played an important role. After all, who in America There is no the legal obligation in America is a moot point. If you wanted to call yourself a Jew, the American government says, okay, we have separation of church and state. As religious status, the arena to fight over it becomes increasingly focused on Israel, all of a sudden in the 1990s moving forward, that's where patrilineal descent plays a very, very important role. In America, see the comments still coming in. In America, it doesn't play a role, but as American Judaism starts to wane in the focus of American Jewish life idiosyncratically, and Israel becomes the major issue, the major arbiter of our Jewish content and Jewish context, that's where the issue's at. But we see that Reform Judaism's decision, despite the fact that Reform Judaism wanted to look, the rabbinical leaders wanted to understand it in its own context, certainly it played a much more important role in American Jewish life generally, both here in the United States as well certainly as in Israel. So happy to take any questions. I saw a few in the chat. Maybe we'll start there. So one question is, conservative movement has not changed to date its position on it adopts matrilineal descent. There are increasingly discussions among individual conservative rabbis who do perform mixed marriages. But that's not the same thing. It's related, certainly, but the status of those children are defined by matrilineal descent, not patrilineal descent.
Would any Reformed Jew define the candidate for vice president as Jewish, since she's married to a Jewish husband?
Good question.
Well, the discussion was never about the spouse always needed to convert. It was always about the children. So nobody was willing to say by virtue of the fact that you are married to somebody who has Jewish bona fides, do you become Jewish? It was always about the status of the children. So nobody ever got into that.
But surely the reform position is if the spouse says, I will bring up my children as Jewish, that's good enough. That makes the children Jewish. It makes the children Jewish, but not the spouse who makes that commitment.
Correct. And the couple in question do not have children.
No, they have adopted right. children. They have adopted.
Right. Right. But it never, it was never the issue. It was always about protecting the next generation and the integrity of their Jewish consciousness. There's some questions about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. There is a second discussion about the activity of the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the 1980s in a very virulent attack. You could add much more to this. The Lubavitcher Rebbe played an outsized role in the Mi-Hudi discussions, particularly in the 80s as well as the 1970s, and was virulently opposed to Reform Judaism. Didn't even, as somebody in the comments wrote, he didn't even refer to them as rabbis. Would upgrade them, give them a doctorate, and didn't negotiate in what you might call denominational politics. If somebody, iPad Toronto has a hand up.
When we talk about the ebb and flow of movements, this one's growing, this one's shrinking. We all remember we've all seen the Look magazine when they thought Orthodoxy would disappear, and it obviously didn't. Do you track how the movements, whether it's conservative, reform, or Orthodoxy, track vis-a-vis their non-Jewish other religions? In other words, right now, the right wing seems to be strengthening. That's certainly in Islam, certainly in South America with many of the Christian denominations. So how much is it just the zeitgeist of society in general? And how much is it any movement doing the right or wrong thing?
That's an interesting question. The movements track numbers of congregations and to some extent member families. That doesn't always translate. Somebody's a member, could be a member of multiple synagogues. It's hard to create unique participants to that.
But no, I
Certainly,
mean
though,
about your analysis. When you were looking and saying this one is growing, this one is shrinking, you know, it's one thing, it's one kind of analysis if conservative Judaism is growing and its equivalent in Christianity is shrinking, or that orthodoxy is and right-wing orthodoxy is growing and Islamic right-wing is shrinking. But when the two track, so then that's more than just one movement doing something right. There's something in the in society, sociological, as I call it, the zeitgeist that is going on.
And then I'm trained as a religious historian, so I come from the school of thought that you don't understand
Understand.
one religion until you understand
Yes,
two.
you
It's a really interesting question. Certainly from a traditional standpoint, the more traditional churches, synagogues are
that now have
flourishing
left.
much, much better.
That's nice.
But we're seeing meaning making and how people identify in their religious experiences very different. So that might sound like a cop out, but I think that how people understand religion in our digital age with social media, I was surprised how many people I follow on Twitter posted a comment or two on Easter. It was very invisible to me growing up, but all of a sudden I saw it. It's interesting to how people signal and people do religion. So I'm not as
Yeah.
convinced based on church or synagogue attrition or attendance that is the appropriate metric for how people do religion. Certainly for many of us who are Orthodox Jews, it is still certainly, or maybe that we pay day school tuition, being probably a better measure of Jewish identity.
She was in Phoenix.
So it's an interesting question. I got to think about it a little bit. It's a very good question. Lauren.
I put this in the chat, but I'll ask you now. In looking at population studies, if you look at the early Reform Jewish children whose fathers were Jewish and mothers were not, if you look at them in later life, do they marry Jews? Do they identify as Jews? Or is there just attrition and they anyways become part of the Gentile society?
Yeah, we see that as you can expect that on the whole, people from interfaith families are less likely to marry Jews. There, what we are seeing, however, is there is some credence to Jewish activity in the home. That, there is a huge philanthropic investment to support this, and therefore there are productive outcomes of the capacity for interfaith couples to educate, to provide some Jewishness in their home. What that means individually for all of you, if that suffices or not, is not my business. But certainly there is a we're seeing a to the most, I guess, most acutely to your question. Is yes, the hypothesis is true that those who come from interfaith homes are less likely to marry a Jew, but we have probably underestimated the ability for interfaith couples to do Jewishness. Does that mean celebrating Hanukkah? Does it mean a Seder of some sort? Does it mean reading PJ Library books? All of these things. So there is something there. And it would be interesting to see of how many candidates for conversion are coming to the Orthodox who are part of that. That's something that I wouldn't know. I don't know if anybody knows other than those movements, if that makes sense. How many families, how many products of interfaith couples are looking now to convert to Orthodox Judaism? I don't know the answer to that question. But I would have to imagine it's certainly more than it was 30 years ago. I know of a few incidences.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good question. And then I know we're a little bit over time already, but Shelley, last question, and then we'll say goodbye.
I don't mean to be a cynic, but it seems to me that it doesn't matter anymore. Most Jews don't belong to any synagogue or don't go. They might celebrate Hanukkah. They might have something they call a Pesach Seder. But especially since 2008 with the financial things, a lot of the non-Orthodox synagogues have merged, gone under, whatever. I mean, in some ways, Chabad is successful because they get people to come in just to, even for a lecture or something like that. The younger people do not seem to want to affiliate in the traditional way of joining a shul or joining a community. What do you have to say about that?
What can I say about that? I think that we're seeing since 2000 a lot of really creative opportunities to inject Jewishness, whether it be One Table, which promotes a Shabbat experience among people who otherwise wouldn't have it, PJ Library that I mentioned, which provides Jewish book content of different types, different age groups for children. Even if any of you, I visited Boston in Lair House, which is just phenomenal, of a Jewish experience, not just a Jewish restaurant. And I identify as a modern Orthodox Jew. So for me, my identity is circumscribed around what I did when I woke up at 6 o'clock this morning. I went to shul. But I still definitely appreciate new avenues and opportunities for people to capture Jewish life. And certainly outside of the Orthodox, you don't need me to say this. There are any number of books, podcasts, and articles about how the non-Orthodox are rediscovering new portals of entry that aren't just about shul. And we're seeing I named a bunch, but we're seeing some other creative avenues as well. Wow. We moved into the present. So it's been great. This is, we'll see if, Rabbi Kelman will have me on again. But in the meantime, it was really great to learn with all of you. We sort of did these interesting chasms, interesting moments that I hope I did justice and, did so respectfully. It's always what I try to do. And hopefully I'll see you again soon. Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.